Thank you for joining At the Root of It. This is Erin Fitzpatrick at the Heritage Radio Network, www.heritageradionetwork.com, out of Roberta's restaurant in Brooklyn.
Word.
That is the voice of Gary Dusek, who joined us last week to speak about the ancient wine and historical migration of vines from the old world to the new world. And we felt like we kind of curbed the show a little bit too soon, so here he is again.
Let's talk more. I love the sound of my own voice.
Most people do, actually.
I got a face for radio. Let's rock.
Let's rock. So where should we begin today? I know that you're very into the primordial aspect of wine and the formation of the world.
Yeah, let's talk more about the what I call primordial and or protozoan. I mean, it may be an incorrect term, but you know, really where wine migrated is through culture, and it's big important. Like if you think about let's talk a little bit about, and I'm just kind of getting off topic here, is like what Romans drank. Romans drank something that's very akin to sherry. Very, very oxidized. There was no corks back in the day. So, I mean, We're talking about things that were not in a bottle. It's in an amphora, which is basically like a jug.
Right.
And, you know, people drank very, very oxidized wine because it was all exposed to oxygen. So we're talking about an entirely different wine than what we drink today. So that's interesting in the sense that, you know, I mean, corks were invented in like 17th, 18th century, something like that, and or just bottles in general. And don't quote me on any of those figures, but you know, I mean, when the cork was invented, it was a huge thing. That's when wine could be transported. That's when wine could really, you know, age and be the wine that we know today. So that's very interesting to think about the evolution of wine since then. Before then, and there's a lot of people that are actually going back to the what I say protoplasmic, but you know, I mean, which is a bullshit term that I just came up with, but you know, it's really is something that people are going back to the primordial aspect of wine. So there's a lot of people that are in, like, for example, Josko Grobner in Friuli, Venice, and Julia. Mm-hmm. He's going back to amphora.
Mm-hmm.
So basically all he does is really put grapes in a huge amphora that gets turned by donkeys.
Right.
You know, the amphora gets turned, you know, basically how they cast the clay is through donkeys, and it's like, it looks like a big top
under the ground almost.
Well, they bury it in the ground. Mm-hmm. And then it's all wild yeast. The amphora itself is porous, so the wild yeast gets in there, and he literally like just throws grapes in there and just leaves it for,
and he's been doing that for a bit
and
of time.
It's expensive
now.
As hell. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean,
well, his wine's not cheap, so it must get passed on
well. And a lot of people that use similar techniques, I mean, it's really expensive, but honestly, they don't, it's non-intervention.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, Let's throw some grapes in the ground. And that is really getting back to really ancient technique.
The roots of how
that
it was,
is how wine was made. I mean, literally, like, people left fruit, you know, fermenting in the sun, and it accidentally got alcoholic, and then they were like, wow, this is pretty good.
Right. So going back to what the Romans were drinking, do you think that their sherry-like beverage...
Retsina,
yeah, quite.
For example, which is coming from Greek, Greco-Roman roots.
Still made quite a bit over there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the thing is that retsina actually is because they coated the amphora with resin in order to preserve the wine. And that's why resin, retsina is resin, basically. Mm-hmm. It tastes like tar and or pine pitch.
Sure.
That's what they coated the inside of the amphoras with.
Well, that's interesting, because there are a lot of the white wines from Greece have that kind of piney character to them.
No doubt.
Yeah. So we go back to now, jumping back to Grobner and how he's kind of coming back full circle to the roots of winemaking and seemingly catching on in a larger sphere with respect to more and more winemakers going more natural, more biodynamic. I mean, as close to primordial ways of operating or winemaking as possible, with it still being a business.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a huge geek wine for mm-hmm, sure. Mm-hmm. Like, no doubt. I mean, it's definitely like something that
not everyone gets.
I don't think everyone would even get it, but at the same time, it's something that's coming to the forefront a little bit more in the minds of people that, you know, are sort of looking for something that's different. I mean, I think a lot of people out there, when they're planning on the $200 price point or something like that, you know, I mean, randomly,
yeah,
they're gonna look for stuff that is crazy.
Yeah,
like they want some impact and they want something that, you know, I mean, literally this wine is taking you back 400 or 500 years in winemaking.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting during the break, I was just speaking to Lorenzo, who is our producer here, and he had mentioned he'd been to WD50 recently for dinner. And when you mentioned how winemaking in this art form is really challenging the consumer in some way, in a directional with food and eating at WD50, that's an experience which is challenging the guest or the eater to really think about food in a different way and appreciate it, its expression in that way.
Absolutely. And the other thing too is what's really important about this is, like, you can also challenge, like, you can have the most conventional food with the most bizarre wine. Mm-hmm. And again, it's challenging your culinary experience, like, beyond, like, I think a lot of people are more open to bizarre alcoholic beverages. I mean, everybody's had a redhead slut, but, you know, I mean, honestly, like, it's, you know what I mean, as a shot, but at the same time, you know, like,
is a redhead slut, is that a sister of the woo-woo?
That's a sister of the woo-woo. No, but, you know, I mean, everybody's had these crazy shots or whatever that I think people are, like, less alcoholically challenged than they are food challenged. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if you can give them, I mean, duck testicle is going to be, like, something that somebody might not order, but at the same time, they're going to order some crazy alcohol.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that wine, when paired and when also, like, you know, sort of presented as the fact that this is going to go great with your dish, this is going to be something fantastic, this is going to be a great culinary experience for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are much more into drinking weird alcohol or weird wine,
yeah,
than they would be to, say, sample, yeah, a duck testicle.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That wine also then would be very...
That's a dish at Del Posto, I think.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Interesting. I think that ends up really being an experiential factor in someone's memory when they go out to dine as well, where they're more apt to, as you mentioned, experiment with drinks and things that aren't necessarily in their minds living.
I agree with that as well.
So segueing into this conversation of primordial methods and whatnot, how do we look at the world in general with respect to how we were talking about last week, the migration of wine vines from the old world to the new world? Before we even get into the continental kind of component, the world existed as, in some theory, Pangaea.
Pangaea.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite continent. This is, you know, we're talking about basically the conglomeration of every continent on Earth. So it's really something that is, you know, plate tectonic, etc. We're talking about more geography than we are about anything, but wine very much segues into geography.
Mm-hmm.
Pangaea is awesome because it's the one continent. So, I mean, we're talking about, basically everything that exists now that was one conglomerate continent, and then it's separated into all the continents that we now have today. What's great about that is that it has nothing to do with wine, honestly, but, you know, what's great about that is that, you know, the world now, except for Antarctica, the Antarctica is the only non-wine producing region.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody was wondering, if you want to go to Antarctica and produce some wine, you probably have a little, definitely
crazy streak in you.
Yeah, you definitely. Yeah. Well, also, you also have a lock on the market because there's no wine produced in Antarctica. Antarctica is actually the only continent in the world that does not produce wine.
Yeah. I imagine those export costs would be rather high.
So it's pretty fresh. Like, if you want to produce some wine in Antarctica, you got the lock on the market right there. But in any case, so we're talking about, like, the world is Pangaea in some level, like, theoretically more than practically. But, you know, I mean, the world is Pangaea as far as, like, wine is everywhere, and it's every continent in the world besides Antarctica. So,
but when you look at the drawing of Pangaea and you see the designation of the different continents, which are now what they've come to be, it's interesting when you do look at from a regional or continental aspect, and you see how, you know, the Long Island could have attached to Bordeaux, and then it shifts, and how there are climactic similarities between these two regions and the grapes that are able to thrive there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Long Island, you know, I mean, it's all about climate, really, when it comes down to it. Terroir is a different story.
Right, sure.
But, yeah, I mean, it's all about climate. When you're talking about the diversity between Bordeaux and Long Island, it's I don't mean to contest you, but, yeah, it's definitely two different stories as far as that's concerned. But, yeah, for sure, I mean, there's definitely... You know, I mean, when you're talking about the transplantation of grapes between countries, mm-hmm. and then when you have a country that has similar
environmental
yeah. absolutely, mm-hmm. environmental
factors, whether it be the Atlantic absolutely. Ocean, whether it be
diurnal variation, mm-hmm. whether it be, you know, terroir influence, whether it be, you know, I mean, all that can totally factor into... Or whether it's an entirely new one, and wow, mm-hmm. you know, Malbec mm-hmm. did great in Argentina. Now we have this amazing Malbec
right.
from Argentina, which is amazing.
Which in Bordeaux, where it was called Cot, C-O-T, did not ever quite pick up the speed.
Yeah, I mean, it's used as a blending grape. It's used as a, you know, it's like the shite filler mm-hmm. situation mm-hmm. where... You know, in Argentina, it's their main grape, like Uruguay Tanat. You know, I mean, we talked about that before. We talked about, you know, different grapes just like coming into their own in different countries. And you see it thrive. And that's what's the beauty of like geographical location, you know, environment, everything that involves like really what it comes down to is like grapes are a product of their environment. And it's, you know, it's like a redhead stepchild. You know, if it's doing bad, they're going to be pissed off and like maladjusted.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think now it's interesting to look at the environmental aspects and the climate change aspects, which are changing the way that people are experimenting with grape varietals in some regions which have never been on the map before, which are seemingly coming into growth.
Absolutely.
I.e. England.
Absolutely.
You had any English wine?
Yikes. the oldest vine in the universe is in England, actually.
Really?
Yeah. It's called, what is it called? Black.
Are you sure you're not thinking about the name?
I swear to God, the oldest vine in the world is like in England. It's called something and I can't remember. It's black something.
It's all right.
Black, it starts with an H.
Well, I think it's some winemakers are looking at it as a very opportune kind of time to plant, but not yet knowing what the long-term ramifications are going to be.
Yeah, I think if England could produce good food, I think they should probably start producing good wine, unless you're talking about Indian food, in which case they produce it.
Not so bad.
They produce great Indian food. I love English Indian food.
Sure. Well,
wine, I would say no England.
No, I mean, I've had a few good sparklers before. I can't deny that. Small production, you know, Chapel Down, or if you have Chapel Down.
I had some great champagne in Heathrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which was from Champagne.
Yeah, probably.
Enough said. Before we get too contentious, we're going to take a short break and be right back.
Why?
Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick. Joining Gary Dusek from Roberta's, the wine guy here, in conversations of Pangea, wine varietals, missionaries, basically getting to the root of the historical aspects of wine and where we are today. So as we mentioned in last week's show, Gary hails from California. What part of California are you from?
From San Jose.
San Jose.
Well, we determine as San Ho.
Oh, dear.
it's not as pejorative as it sounds. It used to be a very agricultural region.
Mm-hmm.
I got shot in the ass with a salt rock for stealing cherries. And I went to college very close to a vineyard. So Silicon Valley is probably what you guys know it as.
Okay. So were you affected by wine when you were growing up? Or is this more of a new, or not new, newish in terms of the last 10 years?
I've been in the restaurant industry for about 16 years. Wine definitely had a major effect on my life, period.
Mm-hmm.
My family's Czech, so they drink a lot of beer, but wine was definitely my grandfather actually looks like Carlo Rossi.
All right.
If you know Carlo Rossi, the jug wine.
Mm-hmm,
my
mm-hmm.
grandfather is basically like looks exactly like Carlo Rossi.
But so, it's not affiliated.
No.
No.
So when I drank Carlo Rossi by the jug, I thought of my grandfather and with respect.
Sure.
California was a major influence, but I sort of reacted against Cali influence and became much more into Italian wine
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
It held more mystery for me.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It held, you know, there's no, everything that I feel like you can see on a California bottle, it's all right on the label.
So how do you feel about the fact that French wine producers are now able in some areas to actually designate what grape varietal is in there? Yeah, thumbs down?
Thumbs down.
Yeah.
Period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't trust a bottle. If Bourgogne, mm-hmm. I don't... If it says Pinot Noir on the label, ciao, ciao. Not into it.
It was interesting because I did a staff tasting yesterday.
I'd rather have a screw cap. That's cool.
Yeah.
Screw cap, cool. Pinot Noir on the label, boom. That's a big thumbs down. I don't know. I mean, honestly.
Well, you're not selling your wine, so it's hard to say from this perspective. But I did do a staff tasting yesterday, and I brought out a Bourgogne, which for our listeners is from the Loire Valley in northern France. And I was showing them the bottle, and I said, "Does anyone know what grape varietal this is?" Thinking that they weren't going to know that it was Cabernet Franc. And before I know it, it is in bold letters on the bottle. And I said,
I don't know. I mean,
Cahors, they jumped on that bad bandwagon fast then.
Like Cahors with Cabernet Franc on the label, I'd kind of be a little bit suspicious about it, just because I feel like it's appealing to people that don't,
sure.
I don't know. I mean, and at the same time, the label's really not important. It's about the juice and the wine, but at the same time, it's how you market stuff is also sort of how you make your wine.
Right, right.
So,
well, then, as you were more influenced by Europe with respect to your own tastes and getting into the industry, when we are now talking about the historical aspect of wine in California, what can you share for us and for our listeners the idea of the missionaries that were cultivating wine in California?
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to the terms of Eucharist, what we're talking about, I mean, basically Spanish missionaries and Roman Catholic in particular, talking about transmorgification.
Otherwise known as...
transubstantiation.
Or transalimentation, another
there you
one.
Go. Thank uh-huh. you. I made up the term transmogrification, but no, but that's the reason why wine is in the New World. So we already talked about that, but you know, there's missions all the way up. There's Mission San Jose. I've been to Mission San Jose. It's from, whatever. I mean, literally Texas and California were part of the Spanish Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're talking about those things, and there was wine produced there. And then other people came in, like, you know, such as the Lone Rangers and, like, you know, people like stoners from, like, the 60s came in to Napa and were like, wow, we have great, we have a great foundation to build on whatever we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Syrah, Grenache, Cabernet Sauvignon, right. whatever we want to do. It was already, you know, more or less there. I mean, they had, you know, they definitely planned some stuff, but at the same time, they just came on, you know, they took a tab and were like, wow, man, this is awesome. Look at the colors. You know what I mean? So they had plenty of raw material to work with so that they could, you know, move forward with it.
Right.
And they knew what they, you know, they knew what the F they were doing, you know, honestly. Like,
so who are the Lone Rangers? Who are they?
You know,
we don't need names, but the idea behind it is
the Lone Rangers were like basically like a bunch of people that, you know, the guy from Bonnie Doone,
Randall Graham, I believe is
Randall
his name.
Graham is probably his name. I'm fact checking right now, actually, on my BlackBerry. you know, no,
who was very influential in the California wine
industry. And a bunch of different people that I don't remember their names, but no, the Lone Rangers in general, like, they just basically like planted a shitload of Syrah, Grenache,
grape varietals, which exist in the Rhone region in France,
and that shitload as well. It was also a grape varietal that I mentioned. But anyways, they basically, you know, came in, did whatever they wanted to do, and it was something that's where Overblown Syrah, all this California style of
very juicy,
very extracted, yeah. lots of alcohol, you know what I mean? And not to say that that's exactly what they wanted to do, but they
right.
saw what worked in Cali and what was different from
Northern
what the old world
Rome.
Style. And this is what defines new world style. I mean, California honestly defines new world style.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for now.
Sure.
And now it's swinging, but the pendulum's swinging back. I can't find buttery Chardonnay anymore. I can't find...
Really?
You know, crazy extracted Cabernet. I mean, you can.
Yeah, you can. You certainly can. Peter Michael, does that ring a bell?
It's tougher. It's a lot tougher, though. I mean, it is tougher to find...
Well, I think that going back to what we were speaking about before with respect to primordial instincts with winemaking... People are realizing, even in Rioja, you know, people who, winemakers who were challenging the traditional ways of utilizing oak and American sure. oak in their Rioja.
They didn't have trees back then as well, so. I'm kidding.
Well, we spoke last week about, you know, Telmo Rodriguez and the Riojas that he's making with new French oak, which are vastly different from Lopez de Heredia.
Sure.
And how more winemakers are coming full circle back to those original traditional ways. And we all know Bordeaux and sure. the consultants like Michel Roland, who have been hugely influential in creating a more modern style. And then now there's kind of a... what's the word I'm looking for? Just a
modern.
A change back to.
Oh, it's, older yeah, school. A transition. Yeah. Like a back to the primordial
backlash
aspect of like
of,
back
yeah.
to the back to the elemental.
Yes.
In my opinion, what I see is the elemental fundamentals of making. I mean, elemental is like really when you come down to primitive style.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that you're primitive. It means that you're breaking it down in the sense of that you're really focusing on what makes wine, period. Like, you have sugar, you have grapes, you have yeast,
right.
you have, you know, air.
Mm-hmm.
You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? It's like, it's really like a fundamental, like, elemental style of stuff. It's, you know, it's like Burning Man or, you know, it's like burning... a fire, you know what I mean? It's like
yeah.
it's really fundamental, and it's really
non-interventionist, just letting the product speak for its own,
just
which is actually
let it do a thing that's gonna
the way
do,
Italians
anyways.
Have always cooked and in a large exactly. a large way that they've made wine. So
exactly
the word I was looking for was reverting back to kind of these
Thank
fundamental
you.
aspects. So
sorry I missed that.
So the Lone Rangers were popularized a bit in just in general with that kind of very extracted, ripe style.
No
and,
doubt.
And, you know, today they're still kicking.
They're still kicking, for sure. Yeah, my man had a funeral for the cork. He basically like did away with the cork, period, with
Who
all his
this?
Wines. He retired. It's the guy from Bonnie Doon.
Okay.
You know his name, I don't.
And he had a funeral for his cork and you were there?
He had a funeral for the cork and he buried a coffin full of corks.
Because he was segueing into utilizing all screw caps.
Everything was screw cap. He had vineyards in Italy. He actually has since retired. I talked to somebody today, actually, yesterday, that was buying the Ruche from Piemonte. It's an indigenous varietal. A really cool woman. And she said, you know, he just dropped out. I think he's retired since, but.
So what were his reasonings for burying cork and saying goodbye to that?
That was it. Because the only thing.
What was it?
The only thing a cork could do is really screw up your wine. There's nothing other than the social stigma. There's nothing that a cork can do besides screw up your wine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really
this has been a very, very pressing topic on the At the Root of It program.
We're gonna
actually continue after a very short break to speak more about this.
The cork. The cork.
Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick with Gary Dusek from Roberta's Restaurant. We're going to end the show today with a very, very important question, which we just tapped onto in the last segment.
Uh-oh.
I think you know where we're going with this.
I'm worried.
Cork or screw cap? You went to a burial for corks not too long ago.
I went to a party.
Party / burial.
A funeral for the cork.
Okay. And this was with Bonnie Doon and... They were saying ciao to cork and hello
ciao,
screw
ciao
cap.
To cork. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, I mean, the only thing that a cork can do to your wine is make it bad.
Well, it can change it. It can alter it.
It can alter it in a bad way.
In a bad way.
It can never alter it in a positive way.
So when we think about aging wine and Bordeaux wines that are meant to be aged for 15 to 20 years and they have a screw cap on them, how do we feel about that?
It could corrode.
We don't know.
One, I think that the major thing is social stigma. The other thing is that are we in the 21st century or no? Like, we should be able to come up with some sort of other material that will do.
Well, I wonder if there's experimentation going on at that moment with screw caps.
We know about tetrachloral anisole, you know?
Sure.
So, I mean, that's the only thing that can happen with a cork, period. TCA is
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other thing that the cork can benefit the wine. There's no benefit to cork, period. So Let's come up with some space shuttle material.
I think we should actually...
I got to the 21st century and all I got was this stupid iPod.
I think we should plant a little time capsule in the back of Roberta's and have some bottles there that are part of our own experiment.
Delicious.
So with that, thank you again for joining us here on the Root of It.
Thank you, Aaron.
Okay, thank you to our sponsor, TechServe, our friends on 23rd Street, specializing in Mac computers, and to our producer and engineer today, Lorenzo Ragioneri and Nat Wiener. See you next week. Thanks. El antifaz que tu maldad cubría.